Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. Yesterday we completed our long scheduled interview with a man who has had more to do with making it fun for humans to move about than any man alive today. It's no small wonder that he got his beginning selling plants for what was arguably the first recumbent bicycle since they got banned from racing in 1934. Laugh with us as we talk with Robert Q. Riley, a man whose life is so huge that it could fill an entire set of encyclopedias. So how are you doing today, Robert?
Very good, Martin. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Robert. Thanks for that. Okay, well, before we talk about your part in the birth of really the modern-day recumbent, I want to talk a little bit about your early beginnings, the early day Robert Riley for a second. Where did you grow up at?
I grew up in Los Angeles, in San Fernando Valley, Vernada Hills, like at the north end of San Fernando Valley.
Okay.
And so I'm a valley boy.
Okay.
You heard of valley girls, right?
Indeed. I've been looking at my notes here, and we've been talking, you and I, since about 1998, so that's almost 10 years now. And I'm just assuming it's 1997 because that's when I do my ride across, so I'm already thinking in that mode. You told me that you're a high school dropout, is that correct?
Yeah, actually, I didn't go to high school.
Didn't even go at all?
No, God. I'm not a dropout, I just didn't go.
Oh, God.
I'm entirely self-educated. Once I graduated junior high school, it's like I might have went to high school for a week, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was it for me. And then I tried going back to school to junior college. I took a college entrance exam, passed it. I went through half of one semester. And school, I could never do school. But I've educated myself. I mean, you could call me a philosopher major, mechanical engineering, industrial design, you know, psychology. Everything in the world is absolutely fascinating to me.
Wow.
And so I it's fun. Like I gave myself a formal logic course because it was fun.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, with hypothetical syllogisms and all this, you know, truth tables, invalid and valid argument forms.
Oh, my God.
I did that. You know what I mean? It's like that was cool stuff.
Wow. So now, what did you do when you're a 13-year-old kid, not in high school? How did you occupy your time? What were you doing, reading books?
Generally messing around.
Oh, God. Okay.
Up to no good. Typical teenager, right?
Okay. So you've got quite the inventive mind, which we're going to discover as we kind of get further down the line with this interview. But where did that come from? Where did you get your what did your dad do?
You know, my dad worked with Kelly Johnson at the Skunk Works at Lockheed in Burbank. And my dad, just like mechanical things, were intuitive for him. And, he's a brilliant man.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to get it from my dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mother had trouble plugging in a toaster, right? But my dad was just very mechanical. He could do anything. And that's the way it is for me. Like, mechanical things are just obvious to me.
Huh.
You know? And once you learn how one thing works, everything works the same way.
Okay.
You know? So, it's all transferable.
So you took that as a kid, and you opened a Schwinn dealership. That was
Actually, I worked for someone else. I managed a branch store for a fellow who owned a... it was a combination of sporting goods store and Schwinn dealer.
I see.
Yeah.
Huh. So this was as a kid, as a 19-year-old, 20-year-old?
Oh, I was 20 years old managing a branch store.
Wow.
It was actually illegal for me to do it because I was about 6 months before I turned 21,
uh-huh.
and we sold guns, and it was against the law for a 20-year-old to sell guns.
Oh, God. I guess. Yeah. I guess. You were selling guns at age 20.
Right.
You were definitely an outlaw at that point.
Right.
1960, you came out, Popular Mechanics published your recumbent bicycle plans.
Actually, that was about 68 or 69 that
68.
They published.
Oh, okay.
Right, but about 1962 or 63 is when I developed that recumbent bicycle.
Oh, okay, okay.
You know what I'm saying? But my idea at the time was to go into that business. You know, bicycle manufacturer, to manufacture that bicycle. But after, like, you know, pursuing it for 5 years and several prototypes and development.
So that was pretty much your start in Popular Mechanics,
do-it-yourself
stuff.
Right, that's the first thing I ever did for them.
Okay, now
what it was a last-ditch effort to try to do some, you know, like sell some plans or something to get some money back out of this thing that I'd invested a lot of money and 5 years worth of development in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's what I did.
Huh. Okay, so are you working at the bike shop while you were building this?
Yeah.
Okay. Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I knew bicycles.
Uh-huh. But
that I had invented a new kind of bicycle. Yeah, when I first developed what ended up being called the Groundhugger in Popular Mechanics, when I first did the first prototype of that, I thought that I had invented a new kind of bicycle. I didn't know that recumbents were from the 30s.
Hmm. And I'll bet you a lot of people shared that thought with you back then, even people in the bicycle industry, right?
They absolutely didn't exist.
Yeah. Wow.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Nobody knew what one was.
Wow.
They disappeared in the 30s.
Uh-huh. Okay, so when that bike hit the Popular Mechanics, hit the shelves, did the sale of that bike go off the charts?
Yeah. The sale of plans was very good.
Wow.
Now that's what I was selling is plans, showing how to build this.
Mm-hmm.
And we sold, you know, in the thousands of plans.
Hmm. And do you remember what they were selling for back then in 1968?
I think it was $5.
Okay.
Huh. Yeah?
Wow. How many would you say of those plans have you sold?
Oh, man. Probably 10,000 to 15,000.
Okay. And you don't sell You don't sell that bike anymore, do you?
I sell the plans.
Oh, you do?
Okay. Still, that original Groundhugger, you could still buy them. Yeah.
Great.
But I've done the XR2, a carbon fiber
right
bike.
Okay.
It ended up winning that big race, you know?
Talk about that. What big race was that?
Okay, that was the Australian, the 2001 Australian World Solar Cycle Challenge, I hope I got that right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a big race they have in Australia every year. And, you know, and there's all kinds of categories. They have these solar-powered cars and different things like that. And there's one category for recumbent bicycles. And let me see, I'm trying to look it up. Okay, here, 2001 Australian World Solar Cycle Challenge. Now, and they have, you know, closed recumbents and open recumbents. Well, an open recumbent is B class. You know, the XR2 is in the B class. And it won in the B class. And it took third place overall with every kind of bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is like, you know, and you know how I got, how that happened?
Who has that?
Okay, one day I'm in my office, right? And we get an email from this school. And people are always writing me for free plans, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so my secretary comes into my office and says, well, we got this request for free XR2 plans. And I said, Debbie, forget it, you know? No. And she says to me, Bob, come on, they're kids, da, da, da. I said, okay, do whatever you want to. If you want to give them a set of plans, give them a set of plans. That was the school that won this big race.
Okay. Wow.
And he said, no, you know, I didn't want to give him a set of plans. You know what I mean? Everybody comes to me for something free. And so I said, okay, Debbie, whatever you want to do, I don't care. Get out of my hair.
Okay. Well, we've talked about this before. How many of those bikes, how many people sent pictures back of bikes that they built?
You know what's funny, Martin? Once people get my plans and they start building something, they don't love me anymore. I mean, it's like they don't care. I don't exist, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, with one three-wheel car plan, there's 30,000 sets of plans I built. They show up in kit car magazines. They win, you know, shows and things like that. I don't even know these things exist. I have, like, six pictures on my website of completed cars. Nobody cares. So I think there's two or three pictures that I have on my website of completed XR2s, and there's like 15,000 sets of plans out there.
Wow.
I mean, they're all over the place.
Oh, God. Okay, well, let's talk about that for a second then, or right. let's just talk about that. You do a lot more than bikes. You design, I'm going to see what I can kind of remember, what my notes have seemed to collect. You do electric cars. Bikes, jet engines.
Yes, I have a jet engine on my site.
Hydrocraft, home gyms.
Yeah, like a personal watercraft, yeah.
Home gyms.
Yeah.
Do you still make gliders?
No, you know, I built a full-size replica of a 1902 Wright Brothers glider, mm-hmm. and I flew it in November of 1972. And it scared me to death. And so, in order to prevent any possibility that I would ever fly it again, I gave it to the museum downtown L.A.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I want to.
You know, it's like, I better get this thing out of here or I'm going to kill myself.
Okay, let's deliberate on that for a moment. We talked about that as well. That was the first, you were the first person to fly the Wright Brothers original glider from 1902.
Right.
In 1972, 70 years later, you were the first person to get one of those up and off the ground. Is that correct?
Right. I didn't know it at the time.
Okay.
I didn't know that I was first. That was not an issue for me. That's not why I was doing it. This was just a cool thing to do, right? Uh-huh. And I found out maybe 10 or 15 years later that nobody had ever done that. I didn't even check. You know, I didn't care. But I was the first to have flown a 1902 Wright glider since the Wright brothers flew theirs.
Okay, now this is not, I want for people that are listening to know that when we talk about glider versus, the Wright brothers flew two different types of airplanes. Tell us about that. 1902 was the glider, 1922?
1903 was the flyer, that was the powered flight.
Okay, 1902 was a glider though.
Right, so 1902 was the year, it's probably the most important bit of aerodynamic work that was ever done. It's the year that the Wright brothers finally perfected how to design an airplane. You know, the airfoil shape, the control system, aspect ratio of the wings. They knew all that stuff. They knew after their 1902 experiment that they could fly. And so what they did is they went back to Dayton, designed the 1903 flyer, which was like an enlarged version of the 1902 glider, built their own engine, built their own propeller, came back and flew the next year in 1903. But when they came back to Kitty Hawk in 1903, they knew they would fly because of the work that they did in 1902 with that glider.
Wow. So when you took it up, got it up in the air in 1972... How old were you at that point?
Well, let's see. I would be 32.
You say you were scared to death. How long were you up in the air for?
You know, I wasn't up in the air for very long, but I was at about maybe telephone pole height. You know, that was as high as I got. Uh-huh. Enough to absolutely kill yourself, you know?
Okay.
And in fact, I did stall the glider.
Oh, my God.
And when it stalled, it pitched nose down straight into the desert. I was never so scared in my life. I was, you know, all the way back on the stick trying to get it to pull out. It hit like it was just beginning to pull out when it hits the ground, crashed up 10 feet in the air, crashed again. Now, what I had a wheel that was installed on that glider so we could tow it, you know, a mm-hmm. single wheel.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only thing that was not original Wright Brothers. And it bent the wheel. And that was all that was wrong with the glider.
Oh, my God.
You know?
Oh,
so fortunately, I couldn't fly it anymore.
Fortunately.
Yeah?
Yes.
And that was on the fourth flight. On the fourth flight is when things really went south on me.
Wow.
And I just, you know, and I'm out in the middle of the desert, Lake El Mirage, California, you know, 50 miles from a hospital. I don't even have so much as a Band-Aid with me, right? And, I mean, that was pretty, well, you know, I was 32, right? 32-year-old guys never get hurt, right?
Uh-huh.
And I didn't really get hurt. I got a skin on my hand.
Jesus. Did you have your helmet on?
What's that?
Were you wearing
a helmet?
Oh,
I did have a helmet.
Okay.
And I had a vest that people wore on ATVs and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
or something. They wore them on something. But I grabbed a vest. You know, it was like a padded vest.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that. And should I tell you an off-color story? So before I went out to the desert, see, I'm looking at this glider, and this wheel is right where my crotch is, right? So I'm thinking, if I ever hit hard, I know where I'm going to get nailed, right? So I took, you know, I grabbed an athletic supporter, a hard cup, you know, uh-huh. off the shelf in the sporting
right.
store.
Right.
I'm going to take this with me, you know, because I know what's going to happen, right? Well, I forgot it. I didn't take it with me. And you know what
no.
happened? Exactly that. Exactly
oh,
that.
No.
I didn't know if I was still any longer a male, you know,
oh,
when
no.
I hit the ground. Oh, man, unbelievable. So.
God. Oh, God.
I knew it was going to happen.
Jeez, you got your bell rung, in other words.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Most definitely.
Okay.
Most definitely.
Okay, now you, what's this about a jet engine? Talk about that.
Actually, I didn't develop that.
No?
A friend of mine from years ago, mm-hmm. when I was going to build a scale model of an F-104, I was looking for a jet engine to power it.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran across this fella in Gardena, California, who had developed this jet engine, you know? And as it turned out, the jet engine wasn't configured in a real weird configuration. It wouldn't work for the model. And but I struck up a friendship with him. His name was Eugene Gluhaus. And Eugene's Gluhaus' father was Sikorsky's right-hand man during the development of the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
They're all Russian immigrants. And so Gene and I developed a lifelong friendship. When he died in 1994, he had plans for these jet engines. You know, that's what he sold. And he sold completed engines, too. Well, I got a hold of his daughter, and she licensed me to do, you know, an updated set of plans for her father's engine.
I see. I get it.
And so, actually, I consider it an honor to be selling Gene Gluhaus's jet engine plans, you know, on my website.
So on your website.
He was a wonderful man, a wonderful man.
Tell the listenership out there what your website is, where people can find all this incredible stuff.
Oh, if they just go to, you know, of course, www.rqriley.com. It's just my name, Robert Quincy Riley, rqriley.com.
R-R-I-L-E-Y.
That's right, yeah,
okay.
rqriley.com.
Great.
Even
okay.
if you don't put in the www, you'll still get it at my website.
Okay.
Okay.
That works. Now,
yeah.
Now, you also design electric cars. Was it you that made the Sparrow? Was that your design?
You know, I've been... No, it's not my design.
No.
But I've been working with the company that bought rights to it
mm-hmm.
from Corbin Motors.
Okay.
And I've been on a retainer with them for probably about a year and a half designing a second-generation version of the Sparrow.
Uh-huh.
And they're about ready to build a prototype of that.
Huh. Okay.
So, yeah. Yeah, I've been involved in that project. As a matter of fact, I was involved briefly with it during the negotiations with this company in Ohio to buy the rights to the Sparrow.
Okay. And the Sparrow, for those uninitiated, I think was one of the preeminent... Well, why don't you describe it?
Well, it's a one-passenger, very cute. It was in one of those Mike Myers movies, Goldfinger kind of movies, you know? Mm-hmm. Not Goldfinger, but... I can't remember the names of them, but, you know, the Mike Myers movies. And so they had the Sparrow in that movie, but Sparrow was manufactured up in Hollister, California. And they must have sold, I don't know, 400 or 500 of them. And the company got into financial trouble. And so that's how this company in Talmadge ended up with them, you know, with the rights to it. They bought all that stuff from them. And basically, the Sparrow, you know, it's a one-passenger electric car. And it had some bugs in it. And so this company that I've been working with, Myers Motors, has spent the last year debugging the Sparrow. So the ones that they're turning out now are really good cars. You know, they don't have weird flaws in them. But my part of the operation was to design the next generation, because they realized that a one passenger car has a limited market. They wanted a two passenger car, and that's what I did, is I designed that car for them, next generation car.
So it sounds to me just a little bit like what Robert Q. Riley Enterprises has been so successful at, is taking stuff that's out there and just fine tuning it. Or taking it to the next level. Okay.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you'd say that.
Okay, what inventions, besides the, I'm going to call it an invention, your recumbent, are there?
Well, you know, I am probably the world expert on three-wheel vehicle dynamics, like road vehicle, three-wheel cars. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've done a lot of work in that, area.
You and Bucky Fuller, huh?
Yeah, and also just about all my work has been oriented towards super fuel economy. You know, in other words, small ultra lightweight cars that will go a long ways on a gallon of fuel, or electric cars. Mm-hmm. But we're just now getting ready to develop something called the XR3 hybrid. It's a lead picture on my website. If you click on that lead picture, you'll go to an information page. Mm-hmm. But that is going to be a 125-mile-per-gallon hybrid electric three-wheeler, two-passenger, very exotic sports car machine. So that really is, you know, things that move. You know, if you can get in it and go somewhere, whether it's a boat or a hovercraft or what have you, then I like it.
Okay. Are you selling lots of your hydrocrafts, your water boats? You selling lots of those?
Yes. Yeah? Yes.
Wow. Yeah. That's a big seller for you, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to kind of
And it's a fun business. You know, Martin, I've been doing this full time since I left the sporting goods business in 1972.
Since you left, the word got garbled. Since you left the what business?
Since I left the sporting goods business in 1972, 73. I've been doing this full-time, product development work, and I love it.
Yeah?
Absolutely love it.
All right.
And, there was nothing more fun to me than to come back and do the original Groundhogger from the 60s, but do it in today's technology. Carbon fiber frame, and you know, I mean, bicycle technology has gone so far since I was involved in it. Mm-hmm. Not even the same product anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, you're talking the XR3.
Yeah, the XR3.
Wow. Okay, great. This has created a lot of opportunity for you as well. You've had The Royal Society of Chemistry approached you about writing a chapter in one of their books. Talk about that just for a second. That was pretty esteemed kind of thing for a high school dropout.
Yeah, I did a actually a chapter in a book on motor gasoline in the that was published by the, let's see, I'm trying to think, I always get this wrong. It was published by, let's see, it was part of something called Critical Reports on Applied Chemistry, published by the Royal Society of Chemistry and the Society of Chemical Industry in the UK.
Jeez.
I mean, it's like really technical stuff, right?
Uh-huh.
And what I did is I wrote the chapter in the book on gasoline. I wrote the chapter on alternative fuels. And the reason they wanted me to write it is really because of my book that's published by the SAE called Alternative Cars in the 21st Century.
Okay, what is the SAE?
Society of Automotive Engineers.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, they published a book for me, a book
wow.
of mine. And,
wow.
So in this alternative energy, alternative car kind of design, it's like I've been, you know, involved in that work since, well, the first energy crisis in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, when I was in gas lines, I thought, hey, there's a better way to do this than this. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, cars were getting like, you know, 12 miles to the gallon back then.
Jeez.
And so the first car I ever designed got 50 miles to the gallon.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was back in the era of the, you know, 12 to 15 mile per gallon vehicle.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Man, I mean, all this. Go ahead. Did it cut
yeah,
you off?
Yeah, yeah. You know, the car that I designed was like 1930s automobile technology.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? It was like not really technically superior. But all I did is remove the size and the mass. It was a 650-pound car, two-place car. It would go 60 miles an hour, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could tool around town. Well, that's why it got high mileage, because you're not carrying a ton and a half of steel around with you.
Right, right. And Costco goods, which is...
Yeah, right.
fills the trunks of most cars. Jeez.
I mean, you know, it's the same thing with bicycling. You know, you want to get that weight down. You want to get the weight down because then, you know, you can go farther on the same amount of energy. There's no
Jeez.
Difference.
You
no difference.
It just astounds me, Robert, all this accomplishment in your life, all these things you've done, and you're still hammering. And it just also astounds me that you had a major, major fire at your house where your home was destroyed.
Oh, I did, yeah.
Your home was destroyed. What did you learn about life from that experience?
Well, you know, what I learned about life is every morning you get up, you know, just thank God that you're here. I mean, you got to value this time because, my garage burst into flames and I was in it and it happened so quickly that it actually sucked the door closed into the kitchen. I couldn't open it. And so, at one point I looked around and saw the situation. And the situation was the whole garage was a ball of fire, and I was trapped. Right? And so I remember at one point giving into it, like, there's no way out. You know, I'm gone. And I wasn't afraid. It was just a sense of accepting reality, right? And the next thing I know, I turned back to that kitchen door, put everything I had into it, and it came open, and I blew into the kitchen, practically exploded into the kitchen, you know, out of that fire. The whole thing from beginning to end was probably 12 or 13 seconds. And I got to tell you, when you go through an experience like that, it changes you, you know? So I just value every day. I really do.
My God, did you lose all of your... of all this incredible gray matter that is in the walls at your home, books, computers, things like that, did you lose any
right.
of that stuff?
Actually, I didn't.
Wow.
It's the most amazing thing. My home was there was a fire department maybe like less than a mile from my home. And once I got out of the garage, you know, and I realized that I'm not on fire, you know, and I'm not dead, I just went and called the fire department. They were there like in 10 minutes. And
10 minutes?
So, yeah, I mean, just like, you know, they were there, right?
It seems like a long
so,
time.
yeah. And so, you know, what happened is the garage was destroyed. like they caught on fire, right?
So, Robert, what of your home was destroyed? How much of your home was ruined?
The garage.
Yeah.
The garage and the kitchen.
Okay.
And the rest of it was smoke damage. And my offices were at the, you know, the opposite end of the house. Computers were all running. Computers ingested smoke. You know, you took the cover off, they were just black inside. And I had, like, four computers. And when I, you know, took the case off and cleaned all the stuff, just cleaned them out, every one of them booted up.
Oh,
there was
God.
Not one loss of data. I did
my
not
God.
Lose one bit of information. Not one file cabinet, not one drawing, nothing. You know, it was dirty, right?
Uh-huh.
I didn't lose the information. It's like
Whoa.
The most unbelievable. How can you go through that, something like that, and not lose stuff, you know?
Wow.
I mean, of course, you know, all my, you know, furnishings, I mean, you know, you just throw them away mm-hmm. because they smell, this hard smell.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take much smoke to make things like, you know, throwing away time. But on a business level, I lost absolutely nothing.
Wow. Okay, well, you know, I could go on for hours talking about all the just incredible things that there are about you, Robert Riley. I feel honored and blessed always to be able to get to talk to you. And I'm so excited that I can share just a little bit that I know with the people that are part of my orbit. So is there anything that you'd like to add?
You know, I can't think of anything, Martin, except that, you know, I don't want to sound mushy, but but you know, if a guy has a dream, you have to go for it. I mean, I have done that all my life, and when I walked out of that sporting goods store, I had $800. You know, I didn't know what I was going to do with my life, and you know, here in like 1973 to 2006, and I've never worked for anyone again, and I have done the most fun things that anyone can imagine doing in their lifetime for me. And you know, you just got to go for it. You just got to do it. This is your only life, you know.
So you're saying to me, just keep building that greenway, huh?
That's for sure. And have a vision, have a dream, and invest, and that gives you meaning in your life. You know, there's no meaning in carrying a you know, a lunch pail into the production line, right?
Uh-huh.
And you know, and it's not like I'm all that brilliant. It's like I'm a guy, right? And so my, you know, go for it. Don't settle for carrying that lunch pail.
Wow. Well, as always, it's a joy to get to talk to you, Robert. It's just a major treat. So... I guess I'm just going to say goodbye.
Okay, thanks, Martin. I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
All right, man. You're the best.
Thanks.
Take care of yourself, Robert.
Okay, you too, Martin.
All right, bye-bye. That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.